Hi, I'm Rick Anthony, and welcome to the Someone You Should Know podcast, the podcast that focuses on musicians, authors, and interesting people. We like to say we're making a difference one artist at a time. So sit back, have a cold one, and get ready to meet someone you should know. I am absolutely delighted to bring to you today's podcast guest. His contributions to music are legendary, and his list of people that he's worked with will absolutely blow your mind. Before this guy even turned 16 and was able to drive, he had a career helping and promoting musicians all over. He has a great new book and some new music out. He's the amazing Stormin Norman Seldon. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, my friend.
I'm so thrilled. I got your CD here. I got your book here. We got a lot to talk about. But first, I want to talk about you. My first job, I was 17. I was making minimum wage working in the mailroom at an insurance company. By the time you were 16, you were already managing events, promoting musicians, and making an impact on the industry. Let's talk about the early days of how this all came to be.
Well, I started formal piano lessons at 3, and unfortunately, I had an abusive father who used to smack me around and smack my mother around, and anything went wrong, I was the one who went flying off the piano. So I practiced 6 to 8 hours a day just to save my life, really.
Wow.
And I entered competitions starting at the age of 7. I was already playing better than most people that were 12 or 13 because I had all European instructors. And if you had a bad lesson, they hit your fingers with a metal knitting needle. And it hurt.
Oh, no.
So if you wanted to find out how the lesson went, you just held your hands up. If you didn't have 25 red spots on it, you had a good lesson. And most of them they didn't speak English. They spoke Russian, German, French. I didn't know what the hell they were telling me except that I was playing the right notes.
Okay.
So it went like that, and then I started doing these, you know, now it's full-blown competitions, but the recitals were competitions, you know, for the different teachers. And it got to the point, I have a photographic memory, which is a blessing and a curse at the same time.
Oh.
So you remember every wrong note, you played every right note. And anything anybody said to me when I was 6 years old, I remember what they said and where they said it. That's why it made it so easy to write the book. But I got out of high school and Manhattan School of Music at 14.
Phew.
And my parents were destined to, they were going to make sure I was going to be a rabbi, a cantor, run their jewelry store, and at worst, play piano a little bit of time. I nixed all of that. And when I heard one of the workers in my father's big jewelry store, he said, come in the back, listen here. He played me Big Joe Turner, Fats Domino, Little Richard, all the New Orleans stuff. I said, I don't want to play this stuff. But I tucked it under because it was taboo in my house. My father was a bassist with the National Symphony and the Philharmonic. My mother's a Juilliard voice student.
Oh, Lord.
But she was the one who backed me the whole time. And I couldn't do much to help her being abused or myself because I was 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. But I remember it all. And it really sunk into me. So when I turned, was out of there at 14 and a half, my mother would sign all my checks. So I started managing all R&B black groups, young, some of them as young as me, and they would rehearse in my parents' front room with the grand piano there.
Wow.
And we'd rehearse there, and then I'd put them on a show. I'd get them all in tuxes. And out of the first bunch, of course, it was a bad thing. Racial thing was rough then.
Mm-hmm.
And I was chastised for having all black groups. My band was 10 pieces then, and everybody in the band was black except for me.
Jeez. And you had an afro, from what I understand, right?
I had an afro bigger than Billy Preston. In fact, we can talk about it later. When I started learning the actual booking agency business, I already knew it from running my shows. I started shows at 14 and a half and was drawing 500 kids every Friday night, 500 to 1,000 every Saturday night. And huge. I had everybody from the Crest to, you know, Santo and Johnny. I had folk shows. I had the Duprees, Vito the Salutations, Johnny Maestro. I had them all at that age. So later on, when I needed them for shows, they already knew me when I was 15 years old.
Jeez. Wow.
So I started recording my first sessions in Broadway recording when I was just turned 15. My mother was paying for things. I would book acts, and my mother would give me the signed check for them because I couldn't sign anything. And I started my own record label, and she had to drive me all the way through Baltimore and Carolina so I could take records down by hand in those days.
Oh my God.
So I was completely R&B, a black radio network from New Jersey to Florida, and had two actually national hits on my own label. out of Red Bank.
Which were the songs? Do you remember?
The biggest one I had with down south was Love, Love, Love it's called The Soul Set. It was featuring Norman Seldon. That was my first group.
Uh-huh.
And it sold close to 7,500 copies on the R&B market, okay, all the way down. So we went, I'd walk in radio stations and they would say, you're in the wrong place, because, you know, it was R&B station. And I said, no, I'm here. And the guy would come in and said, that's Storm Norman. He only handles black acts. He's in the right place. And we go in with the program director, and the one day they said, oh, we have Harry Ray of the Valetairs in the studio. Harry Ray was in New Jersey. I'm in Baltimore, so I had to pretend I was him. And when we got in there, the guy said, lock the door. He put the record on, and he played it five times in a row. And the other guy was shaking on the door. What's going on? You know, he didn't open it until he was done. The thing, he said, I was interviewing. I was talking like it was Harry Ray. I didn't sound, I don't know what the hell he thought. But I did the interview. And then you may have heard of him, because he was big in New York, all over the world, called Douglas Jocko Henderson.
Wow, yeah.
And he controlled the R&B market, and he became a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I went to his home for lunch and dinner, and he said, how old are you? I said, at that time, I was just turned 17. He said, well, I want you to come to the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem and do a show with the Valetairs, because the record was breaking, you know. I said, yeah. And he takes me up there, and they have King Curtis, Billy Stewart, Jackie Wilson, and it's a week after got assassinated there. What the hell was his name? Malcolm X got assassinated.
Yeah, so there's a lot.
So I'm in an all black room. The only other person that was white was the Jewish guy behind the grill. He was taking the money.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I can't go on this show with these kids. He said, you're gonna blow them away. And then the backup band, all of them didn't show up. King Curtis, instead of playing sax, says, give me a guitar. I'll do the show. And so I said, what? And I said, we're going to get slaughtered after. He said, no, they're going to love these kids. And they did. Everybody kind of said, wow, what an amazing group. He said, now I have to get you back to the car. He said, walk in and go straight home. Don't stop. And I mean, I went to go to the bathroom, and I'm at the urinal. And the guy next to me is going, and he opens his leather coat. He's got a sawed-off shotgun.
Oh, jeez.
And I said, I think I had the quickest time in the men's room.
I don't have to pee now.
I went up by the piano, and the tracing from Malcolm X was still around the piano area.
Oh, my God.
Where you've been shot. And I looked down at that. I started to get in the willies. I'm 17 years old, turned 17. So it's a lot of neat stuff. We did the show. It went over great.
Yeah.
And then Jocko brought me to introduce me to the R&B radio network at Ray Charles on the Tangerine Music.
Uh-huh.
The meeting was there. And he said, bring a couple boxes of records for each one you have out.
Okay.
So I came to the meeting, and everybody was there, from Fat Daddy, Chatty. Everybody was in the R&B thing when I was young. He said, Norman only promotes black acts, and his own label. So I want each one of you to make this a pick hit of the week on all your charts. Now, that's every station down in Florida. And one guy said, what do you get out of it? He said, well, Norman brought records for me. In those days, they sold the records at their shows, and, you know, they got 50 cents for a dollar for them, and that was kind of their payola then. And the real nice ones, I brought watches from my parents' jewelry store. My mother brought like 12 beautiful watches, give them to the program directors. We get all the airplay we wanted, trust me. But that was, I guess that was our payola for the time.
Yeah, payola was alive and well back in that day. Yeah, it's, these stories are just absolutely amazing, Norman. I love talking a situation like this when you get to sit and talk to someone who's lived an incredible life, and you certainly have. I want to ask you the origins of the Asbury sound. You were credited for being one of the originators of that sound. How do you define the Asbury Park sound?
In reality, it's a combination of rock, blues, that was carved by people like me, and I was the first one to put horns on my tracks.
Mm-hmm.
Back then, nobody. I always had 2-3 saxes on there. Then Southside Johnny started with the saxes and the Jukes. It's a combination of R&B, rock and roll, maybe rockabilly, but it's all put together. It's hard to describe. It really is. It's music, and it just happens it became a mecca there after the. I was a young kid running shows in Asbury before they had the race riots and all the places were burned down. And it was, you know, quite dramatic, to say the least, to see what was there before when I was a young kid and then look there and see it all burned down. And it was a ghost town for years. So I saw it all. And so when they put out the Originators, of course, my name's right under Bruce Springsteen, but actually I'm an Originator. Yeah. I mean, he came along. He was in my audience watching my shows with Miami Steve Van Zandt.
Oh,
they were
geez.
Out there in that audience, and they weren't much younger than me. They're maybe a year or two younger. That's where they saw the Rascals and all. I was the first one to put the Rascals on in New Jersey after they appeared with the Beatles at Shea Stadium.
Oh, dear Lord. Jeez.
So it just keeps rolling. You know,
wonderful,
you keep going
wonderful,
and going.
Wonderful, wonderful memories. Several items we need to discuss. First off, we've got an album I've got right here. Timeless Memory, Storm and Norman, Selden and Friends. And you also have a book out here. The book is called You Don't Know Me, Norman Selden, as told by Charlie Horner. We're going to talk about the book in a bit, but I want to delve into the CD first. And on the inner sleeve, you're honoring the legendary Larry Chance of the band The Earls. What's your relationship with Larry?
Larry, I started booking for my teenage shows. I had him a couple of times, you know, through a regular agency in New York. Then we became friends, and of course he knew me from then. And I started learning in a legitimate booking office, because I had my own, with Jimmy Lamar, who used to be the head guy of GAC. So he went into his own private booking with bands, and he still booked all the oldies acts, but his daughter didn't want to go to New York from South Jersey every day, and I could type 100 words a minute, do contracts. So he brought me in, and he introduced me to his associate in the office, was Myron Cohen, the Jewish comedian from years ago.
Yeah, I know him.
And he was very Jewish. You know, he looked over, he said, "This is a Jew." I had the afro, and Jimmy said, "Yeah, not only that, he types 100 words a minute. He knows everybody in the business, and he can probably take care of all of our contracts in one day that we've been hanging around with for 3 weeks." So, you know, cut him some slack. And then he had me call these groups. I called Larry, I said, "Larry, it's Norman." He goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm up here working with Jimmy Lamar, helping him out. He's going to book my band, some of my shows, and I want to be able to book you." He said, "Look, I'm getting ready to get a day job. The British Invasion came in and Motown." He said, "Nobody wants us as good as they were." I said, "That's crazy." I said, "Give me 2.5 weeks." He said, "Norman, this isn't the same as when you were running your teenage shows." I said, "Give me 2.5 weeks. Meet me at the Ed Sullivan Theater building. Bring yourself and the other two singers up at the time." There's Ronnie Calabrese, and there was another guy that was with the Mellow Kings, Tony. They came up. I said, "Just a piano. You guys, let me see what you're doing." Because I did all the black groups, got them organized, and that was an impossibility. They had no recognition. I still got them up there. And he came up. We rehearsed. I said, "First thing, Larry, what's out?" He said, "Well, Beatles." I said, "What are they wearing?" He said, "These Nehru suits." I said, "Good. You're going to all get white Nehru suits." He said, "What?" I said, "White Nehru suits, not tuxedos, now Nehru suits." I said, "We're going to add like vehicle, Ides of March, a couple things to all your other stuff. So somebody sees you doing something besides just the oldies." I said, "And let me work on it for 2.5 weeks. Don't make a move until I get done, you know, with seeing what I can do." So he came up 2 or 3 times. We rehearsed some stuff. It was coming along good. And then I said, "Oh, boy." He was up on a Monday. I called him on Wednesday. I said, "Larry, can you come into Manhattan?" He said, "We were just there Monday." I said, "Larry, can you come into Manhattan? I've got contracts." He said, "You found a job?" I said, "Yeah, I found a few jobs." So he said, "Okay." So, "Well, you sure you can't sign it?" I said, "Larry, I'm 17. I can't sign your name." I said, "But I've got deposits." He said, "You got deposits on everything?" I said, "Larry, just come in." He came in. There were 40 contracts I got for him.
Oh, my God.
I said, and they were getting in those days like three and a half max, you know.
Uh-huh.
And he said, did you get 300? I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Where are they at?" I said, "Well, you don't have to really worry." I said, "I've got a 50%. They said, "Deposits already?" I said, "They're already in. Non-refundable, pay or play." "You got 300, 350? I said, "Larry, I got you 500 to 750 for the same stuff you're doing." "Jesus, what's that going to cost me?" You know, I said, "Same 10%, Larry. I want you to work. I don't want you out of the business. And by the way, if you call up Don Imus, he wants somebody for early morning to Larry did great comedy and different voices.
Oh,
he
seriously?
Did a Mexican comedy. It was great. So I said, "Call up Don Imus. He wants somebody, but you got to be there 4 in the morning. And he said, "All right, I'll give him a call." Well, he hired him to be Santana Banana on his radio show.
Oh, gosh, I didn't know that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and Larry was Santana to Banana. And he called me at 4:30 in the morning. I was very busy in those days at 4:30 in the morning. He called me up at 4:30 and said, "Good morning, Mr. Stormin Norman. This is Santana Banana." I said, "Larry, I'm going to choke you right for the phone." And he said, he started laughing. He said, "You have a nice day, senor." I said, "Gah." I said, so we were that close. We were that close.
Jeez, jeez. Well, he's featured on this beautiful project, A Timeless Memory. We're going to feature a song that actually features Larry Chance and the Earls, I Who Have Nothing. Any particular reason why you decided to use this particular song on A Timeless Memory?
Nobody, except for maybe Johnny Maestro in this era, had the dynamics and the presentation and the beauty of a voice that the diction was clear, the melody was pure, the riffs were simple enough to just give it a little extra edge. And he never overplayed anything. And I just love doing this job on this thing here. I just thought it was great. And people love Larry. Larry had no enemies. If he didn't like you, he just didn't talk to you. He didn't say anything bad about you. But he said, "Tell you what, Norman, you teach me how to book, and I'll teach you how to sing." And he did.
All right.
So that's as close as we were.
All right. Here is the late, great Larry Chance, a.k.a. Santana Banana, and the Earls, and I Who Have Nothing on the Someone You Should Know podcast. Nothing, the late, great Larry Chance from the album A Timeless Memory. A new album on today's podcast featuring Stormin Norman and friends. Great stuff. We'll hear more of that coming up in the podcast. But first, I want to say thanks so much for tuning in to the Someone You Should Know podcast. We're heard on the web, someoneyoushouldknowpodcast.com. If you go there, you'll see our recent episode archive of over 180 episodes. And a whole lot more. You get a chance to see the recent news and everything else we've got going on. If you happen to be visiting, we invite you to leave us a review. According to Buzzsprout, the service that shares us to all the streaming platforms, thanks so very much. We're so blessed to reach over 2,200 cities in 90 countries around the world. And we want to salute a couple of cities. Romulus, Michigan, Park City, Utah, Fort Myers, Florida, and Zurich, Switzerland. Somebody You Should Know podcast heard wherever quality streaming audio is available. Thanks for listening. We're speaking with Stormin Norman Selden. Stormin Norman, I'll tell you one thing. You've done something that Leslie has been on me to do for years, and I'm not talking about remodeling our house. It's writing a book.
You Don't Know Me. Great book. I've had a chance to review it last couple days. The pictures, the stories are just will absolutely blow your mind. And I got to ask you, what motivated you to share your story at this particular moment in time?
Well, you know, COVID kicked in. We couldn't do any performing. And I was, of course, I was an artist in residence, a Steinway artist with Jacobs Music, which was a Steinway dealer. So I said, geez, this is going to be, you know, it was the only time in my life I ever got unemployment was then the company, all the stores closed because it was so bad. And I said, what am I going to do with this? So I just called Charlie on the phone. I said, Norman. I said, yeah. He said, Charlie, got a question for you. You think you would want to write a life story, like true story?
Mm-hmm.
He said, definitely. I've been following you for, you know, 18 years. He said, I know almost everything about you except what you're going to tell me. Yeah. I said, well, when do you want to start? He said, now. So we started that day, about a 3-hour interview. Every week we did about 3 hours for, I guess, 12, 14 weeks in a row. Mm-hmm. And as he would write it, he would send me to make any corrections. And he was looking up, he has this ungodly resource to find everything about. He found ads and articles from all over the United States and Europe and Canada that I didn't get to see because I came in for a day and be gone. He said, we don't have enough pages to put this stuff in there. We can use, you know, 15 or 20 along the pages. But, Norman, there's 300 articles and ads that you never even saw because you did the show, you left town. I never saw anything. He had them all. So we picked out stuff like that. And I'd look and he said, what haven't you done? I said, I don't know. I don't pay any attention to that stuff, Charlie. He said, where's this coming from? I said, you have notes written? I said, no, it's all out of my head. He goes, what? I said, I photographed. I said, everything bad or good that ever happened to me, you know, comes out. So yeah. I would just talk. He would tape and listen. He'd send, if he had a question before he even started to research, he would call me, what about this, this, and this? I said, that's what this is. And he'd look it up, and he'd just send a smile and goes, why are you always right? You know, he said, I'm looking stuff up. He said, you don't even know about these, but the other couple hundred things you don't forget. I said, nah, I remember the first wrong note I played in my piano lesson. It horrifies me every time I hear a student play it, and it drives me crazy. And we just wrote it like that. And it came out, and one of my very good friends from years ago, he said, Norm, we really need a nice cover. I said, well, I'll tell you what. I said, I'll get my friend Susan, and he said, Susan, who's Susan? I said, Susan's been with major company doing all their art and graphics for 18 years. I said, and I'll find out what she wants to charge for a cover, you know, because it was major. She was with Elizabeth Arden for 18 years. She designed the White Diamonds bottle for Elizabeth Taylor, uh-huh. All the stuff for Karl Lagerfeld. That was her. And I helped get her, you know, through a lot of situations. And she did the cover art, and the only thing she said is, listen, the times have changed now. You used to be able to tell me what to do. Now, when I give you a cover, you're going to get the up-to-date, state-of-the-art cover that most people pay $3,000 a page for. I said, what's this going to cost me? She said, nothing, but you're going to take what I give you.
Okay.
Because it'll be the way it's supposed to be. When that came out, and I saw that cover, and the photographer who took it was shooting Alice Cooper and Alicia Keys, so she came in and she shot the cover photo.
Love it. I love it. It's absolutely fascinating. I got to ask you, where is it available at?
You can get it on Amazon.com.
Okay.
It's available there. I can send it from you. It's probably easier for them to get it on Amazon.com.
Okay.
Just put in the title, you know, and that. And there's 8 or 10 reviews on it, but it's sold multiple thousands of copies, and it's a self-published book, so that's not bad.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. And you got help?
And what's that?
And you got help from Charlie Horner to get it all together? That's amazing.
Charlie's amazing. In fact, he came the other night because he's going to Jazz Fest in New Orleans. He wanted to know if I want to go down there. I said, no. And I said, I can't do that. I got these interviews. I've got to watch after my house. They're doing things out, you know, since my wife passed away. It's only been 8 weeks. So just kind of get things in order. And he came and brought me dinner the other night, him and his wife. She's also a historian. We went and had a great dinner. And he got more artwork for the Asbury Park Museum, which he's the head of. And they'll have something real special coming out about that. And, of course, I've got about a 14-foot run on that thing of all stuff that I did that they previously displayed, you know, that were supported by national donations. So it's going to be an interesting next couple of years. I can't say too much about that, but it's in the works. Wow. And that's the best place to get it. If they want to get the purple vinyl album, which is a limited edition or something, they can call me 732-245-4777, and I'll get the information what they want and get their credit card number, and then I'll mail it to them.
We'll include that down in the show link. So if anyone who's driving right now and wants that information, just check the show links when you get a chance to find a place to stop. And I want to say, from another person who has lost his wife that they dearly love, sincere condolences on the loss of your beautiful bride. And we wish you the best. This first year is going to be the toughest, but we wish you the very, very best, my friend. And know that she's watching down from heaven on you every single day, because I know my wife is too.
Well, I went every morning and every night before I did Jacob's or any of my performances. If I had to do a performance, I had a best friend come in to make sure she was fed, put in bed, TV was on, and everything was, you know, mm-hmm. did the best I could do. I was working on 3 hours sleep a night, 4 hours sleep for 4 years straight.
Oh, geez, I know the feeling.
So this is the first time that I've actually slept 6 or 7 hours in 4.5 years.
Jeez. Well, it's a struggle. I know grief is really, really a struggle. So God bless you, my friend, and we'll be praying for you. I want to feature some more music from a timeless memory. This is one of yours, Flip, Flop, and Fly, the old Big Joe Turner song. Why'd you decide to include this one?
Actually, I've been doing it for years and years, and I was at the Garden doing a backup band thing for God knows how many groups. The regular backup band could not make it, and I was working with Banner Talon at the time. They said, "You think you can cover this with your band?" I said, "Sure." He said, "Well, a little note, if the show runs short, you know, it's a union thing." He said, "If it runs short, 5 or 6 minutes, you may have to go out and play a song just to close the show." I said, "That's not a problem." The guys in the band said, "Well, what are you closing with?" I said, "I haven't thought about it yet." They said, "Well, hello, it's in 2 hours. What are we doing?" About 10 minutes before, just when the last group was coming on, I said, "How about Flip, Flop, and Fly?" He goes, "We haven't done that in 15 years. I said, "Great, we're going to do it today."
Oh,
he
geez.
Said, for 20,000 people? I said, "Sure, why not?" And he said, "Hey, when you start," I said, "we're going to get the audience clapping, and you're going to start with the drums." I said, "And then we're going to come in, and everybody's going to take solos until the time is up, and they'll love it." They went ballistic.
Awesome.
Hadn't rehearsed in 15 years, at least. He said, "How do you remember that stuff?" I said, "Hello." You know, they're all up there. So we ran them through. It went over great. The guy came over and said, "I don't know if these groups want to follow your band ever." I said, "Well," I said, "it's a really good band." And we didn't have a multiple horns. We were just guitars, drums, organ, piano, you know, that kind of thing, and good harmony.
Yeah.
He said, "Wow." He said, "What happens with the horns?" I said, "Forget about it." You know, so it went well. And that's when I said, "You know what, let's record this thing."
Uh-huh.
And we did. And it came out great.
It
and
sure
my,
did.
My sax session, the players are from Tower of Power, Gloria Estefan, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. They're the best.
Absolutely.
One of them's first call for Elton John. They're all on my show. They'd rather come play my live shows for less money than they do with those people. Because I let them play, you know, and they have fun. And they all went to college about the same time, so it's neat. It works well.
Very good. The album's called A Timeless Memory. Storm and Norman, Selden and Friends. This is Flip, Flop, and Fly on the Someone You Should Know podcast.
When I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. I'm on my way back home. Ooh, I said,
say good goodbye. Goodbye.
Originally released in 1955, done wonderfully by my podcast guest Storm and Norman Seldon and friends. More great music on the way. One thing I have to ask you, it says right on the cover there, you are one of Steinway artists in residence. Can you explain what that all means?
Well, when you're with a Steinway dealer, which I'd had some health issues early on, and I was doing 300 nights a year, 320 nights a year. One year I did every night, all 365 days and nights. They found out that one of the deans at one of the colleges was a friend. She said, let me put you up on searches for people that are trying to hire. You know, I said, mm-hmm. Fine. So it's going to take about 2 or 3 months for it saturates, but, and this is 18 years ago. So I said, fine. I didn't know what a resume was. I didn't need one. I had one for music. That was it. She wrote it. She put it up. I'm on the train to New York with my wife for something for her jewelry store. And cell phone rings, and it's a headhunter. And I said, Jamie, what's a headhunter? She said, Norman, that's what I was retained as in Atlanta for years. She said, what do they want? He said, we have a company that really wants you bad. I said, where are they? He said, Philadelphia. I said, I'm not going to Philadelphia if you stand in your head. I came to drive in the town. He said, well, they'd like to talk to you. Could you at least make a meeting? I said, sure, I'll go for the meeting. And they called me, and I went. They were fighting in the hall, which one of the seven locations that I could go to. They wanted me all over. Mm-hmm. And I ended up starting with them. And they never really heard me play too much. In fact, I don't think the owner, who was an excellent musician, ever heard me play. And he was a great accordionist, and you know, the whole family was musical. I've Curtis School Music in Philly with his wife had gone. It was amazing. And they hired me, and I wasn't used to that stuff. But as I started to play, when they did a memorial for the owner, he passed away like 9 years ago, 10 years ago, there was a big stage, South Jersey, the concert stage, and all the other musicians, the doctorates of music that played classical music, were on the show. And they said, well, can we have a list of your program for the pro? I said, I don't make programs. What? You have to have programs. I said, no, I'll wait and see what goes on before me. I'll decide. Well, give us something. I said, great. Knights in White Satin. And I don't know what. So I gave two fairly like late 60s, early 70s things. And just left it at that. And he said, that's what you're opening with? I said, I don't know what I'm opening with. You know, so I went up there, and after the three classical deans of music played, which they had doctors, they were phenomenal players, but the people were falling asleep. Mm-hmm. After, you know, 2 hours of classical music put anybody to sleep.
Oh, yeah, a little Shostakovich, really, or, you know, Rachmaninoff, you know, or whatever.
And they played, they were marvelous, trust me. It was top shelf. And I went up there, and I had the original pianos from Steinway. I had the 9-footer in front, and then we had the Horowitz piano, his personal piano, next to that. Mm-hmm. So I came out in my jacket and my bolo and my cowboy hat, and I said, I hung my cowboy hat and Horowitz's piano lid just to hold it. And everybody was laughing. I took my jacket off. I said, now I'm more comfortable. And I brought out another guy that was a Steinway artist at the time. We played Four Hands Ragtime just to open the show. Mm-hmm. And we changed seats. I walked around. He keeps the left hand going. I keep the right hand going. We changed seats. They went ballistic for that. He went off the stage, and everybody's out there. Just mouths were dropping, because I'm a weird guy to be in that, you know, that bunch of people. Mm-hmm. And I started to play, and I did it. Send In the Clowns, and the technicians in the back were going, what? They're going, what are you doing? I said, they're waiting for me to wreck the piano. You know, I said, yeah. I did Send In the Clowns. I did Knights in White Satin. I did a little intro to a Bruce thing, which I never do because I'm not a fan, uh-huh. Bottom line. But and they thought I was doing Thunder Road. I stopped in the middle of that, and I started playing Randy Newman's Louisiana, and I sang it. And they didn't realize nobody had sung a song that whole 2 hours.
Oh, geez.
It was just piano.
Gosh.
And their eyes opened. Well, as soon as I started the intro to the Springsteen song, you got that noise out of the crowd. And I looked down, and I went right into Randy Newman and just absolutely slayed them. They're just standing ovations all the way in the back. That's 2,800 people. And then I went all the way through all these different things, and I did it with a piano technique like the Doctors of Music did it with. Mm-hmm. They're sitting out there with their mouths dropped because they know me as a piano salesman. And I went in, and at the end, I did a whole lot of shaking and a couple of, New Orleans things, and had everybody clapping in the whole audience.
Wonderful.
Absolutely nuts. And if I wanted to go back out for an encore, I could have with no problem. And I got done with that. I walked in the back and said, "How in the hell do you do that?" I said, "That's called years, my friend."
Yeah, yeah.
When I came off, I went and sat next to the owner's wife, and she said, "Who knew?" I said, "You didn't ask." And I saw the two professors that I know from Jacob's Pianos, the big Steinway store. They said, "My God, you play rock and roll with a classical technique." I said, "That's how I was trained." Yeah. I said, "But you never told us." I said, "You never asked."
Yeah, that's just it. You never asked.
And the one guy from Russia who was a great piece said, "I am so glad." He said, "You not go on before us. There'll be nothing left for us."
I love moments like that. I want to make sure everyone knows where they can find you, your social media and such. I know you've got a website. Can you tell us some ways that we can reach out to you?
I'll give you the website, which is www.stormandnormanseldon.com.
Mm-hmm.
They can reach out to me there. They can write me personally at normanseldon@aol.com,
okay,
or normanseldon1@gmail.com.
All right.
Or they can call me, 732-245-4777.
All right. Very good. I will include those down in the show notes. We're going to wrap up the show with Tonight's the Night, done by Doreen Arminio. Can you tell us a little bit about about this particular inclusion?
Doreen is the actual name of the actor, Stiletto and the Sax Man. They tour all over the country. They're on all the major shows. We see a Golden Oldies show. They're on it. She actually has a tremendous, not just the high voice for the oldies. She sings some legitimate stuff. She's got a great voice. Very special. And I love her to death. Her and her husband, they're two great people. They do tracks when they do their shows. And if they're with a band, they fit right in. We did a big show January 28th, and Doreen came up. I had my 10-piece band there, and she sang Gee Whiz, and she just slays the place. And then her husband came up and played sax with when we did the New Orleans medley. Very talented family. Her voice is very unique, and she probably knows 1,200 songs. So whatever you throw at her, especially in the Golden Oldies, she's got them all.
Awesome. Awesome. We're going to feature that to wrap up the show. Tonight's the Night, great song that's part of this wonderful project called A Timeless Memory, Stormin' Norman Seldon and Friends. Once again, go down to the show notes. I'll tell you exactly how you can get this. And it's a great book also called You Don't Know Me. Yes, you do. You do now that you've had him on the Someone You Should Know podcast. Norman, thank you so very much. God bless you. Thank you for all the wonderful contributions you've made to the music world, and we really and truly owe you a debt of gratitude, my friend.
Well, but thank you for having me, and like I said, I just like to put it out there now. I have some time to do that, and I appreciate it all, and like I said, I'll be doing a couple dates a month. I'm still kind of recovering from the last 8 weeks, but everything's good. I'm happy, and again, hello to all your fans, and to you, get your book done, okay?
I promise you I will. God bless you, my friend.
You said you're gonna make
Hi, this is Rick Anthony, thanking you again for listening to this episode of Someone You Should Know. Now, if you're an aspiring musician or an established musician that's looking for a little exposure, I invite you to drop us a line at someoneyoushouldknowpodcast@gmail.com. That's someoneyoushouldknowpodcast@gmail.com. Also, I invite you to tell a friend about the Someone You Should Know podcast. I thank you for tuning in this time, and I invite you to check us out next time on the Someone You Should Know podcast, because you never know who's going to show up. Until next time, remember, God loves you, and so do I.